Let's talk about a little bit of football this morning. We're spotlighting Amherst, and we always like to have local author Wayne Stewart. Good morning, Wayne.
Hi, how are you?
Not too bad. Always, you're a pro, I would use the word prolific as far as writer for you. And it's all really about sports. A lot of times it has an attachment to, I guess, your youth or your passion for that. Let's talk about this new book you have called America's Football Factory. What made you decide, hey, this is a good topic for a book?
Well, actually, at that point, I had an agent, and he came up with the idea. I wanted to do a book about a former classmate of mine at Denora High School in Pennsylvania, Ken Griffey Sr., but he said that's been overdone, and he came up with the idea. He said, you know, Western Pennsylvania's produced tons of great football players, and specifically quarterbacks, so why not do a book on along those lines? So I said, yeah, that's a natural. And because I grew up basically one town down the Monongahela River from where Joe Montana grew up, I had access to tons of people who played with him, knew him, coached him, what have you. And so it really was a natural to do a book about that. And then extending from that, I was able to meet, or rather make contact with, for example, relatives of Johnny Unitas, who grew up near, very close to Pittsburgh, Mount Washington. So no, it was quite natural to do that book.
Wayne, you mentioned John Unitas. Let's talk a little bit about him. Of course, he was involved in that 1958 championship game that kind of put the NFL on a map in a different light. What did you find so fascinating about his story?
Yeah, it was fascinating for sure, because he was one of those guys who, out of high school, was recognized as good, but you know, they said he was too small to go to Notre Dame, which was his dream. A lot of the Catholic kids out of Western PA, you know, there was a sort of a pipeline to Notre Dame. But instead he went to Louisville. Again, you know, good statistics, but it was to the point where the Pittsburgh Steelers drafted him, but they didn't use him. The truth is, he didn't take one single snap when he was in training camp, and then they cut him loose. He goes to a semi-pro team called the Bloomfield Rams, something like $6-$10 a game he's getting paid. They told me that the field was you know, dirt, and there were stones and I think pieces of glass, whatever, you know, maybe legend exaggerates. But at any rate, virtual obscurity. Then the story is either an anonymous phone call or a letter comes to Weeb Eubank with the Baltimore Colts. And they decided to give the kid a look, and boy, from there it just took off. And, you know, as they say, it was just history, especially with him and Raymond Berry, who also set records with Johnny in that 58 game that you described.
The six Hall of Fame quarterbacks that you look at, George Blanda, Johnny Unitas, Joe Namath, Joe Montana, Jim Kelly, Dan Marino, there's some generations that separate them. Were other youngsters inspired by previous legends from their community? Does that happen in a way?
Oh, sure. I asked people, one of the themes of the book was, you know, how does this happen that six quarterbacks from the same basic area? I did a little bit of research. The Pittsburgh area that I'm discussing represents less than 1% of the total, let's say, square miles of the United States. But almost exactly 25% of all the quarterbacks of the modern era in the Hall of Fame are from that area. So naturally, when I spoke to people, they said one big influence was a younger kid like a Namath or Marino says, I want to be just like Johnny Unitas or Blanda. And football, like Ohio, Pennsylvania's not exclusive, and certainly lately it's been California, Texas, Florida. But one of those areas where it's a hotbed because football's in the bloodstream, so to speak.
It's one thing to be a player, but you need a coach and you need a mentor. Were there people behind the scenes in that area that sort of set the groundwork for good programs in those schools?
Yeah, I talked to, in fact, a local official here in Ohio, and he said that he had heard that the quality of coaching in Western Pennsylvania was extremely high. But he had an interesting theory. He said that it was also just as high here in Ohio, but the difference was everybody in Ohio knew that Woody Hayes was going to be the you know, run the ball three times, cloud of dust, that cliche, but it's true. And so what would happen is a guy who had a good arm was more likely to go to a school in, well, I shouldn't say likely to go, but more likely to be nurtured in Western Pennsylvania than perhaps here in Ohio. It's just a theory, but I thought it was interesting.
You mentioned coaches. Let's move on to your other book, Remembering the Greatest Coaches and Games of the NFL Glory Years. Now, was this your idea? Is this one that you wanted to do, or was this another publisher pitching a story idea?
No, usually the idea comes from something I've seen or read or whatever. But, yeah, I had done a book earlier for the same company about the greatest players of all time. And it was really great. I got to speak to, you know, it's funny. If I talk to an athlete now and interview him at in the clubhouse of Cleveland Indians or whatever, it's not the thrill like when I was a kid admiring Hank Aaron and then getting to talk to him. So that book, The Great Players of the NFL, was fun to do, talking to a lot of these old-timers. Like Raymond Berry, and I realized I had so much good material left over that there was probably room for another book, and so the editor agreed, and we went to the sort of a sister or companion book with the coaches in great games.
Wayne, do you think some of these great coaches, as you describe, I assume we're talking about Vince Lombardi and Tom Landry, do you think they would be as effective today as they were back then?
The first instinct is to say no, because a guy like Lombardi was so hard-nosed and so on. But I also suspect these are the kind of guys that would adapt. And my gut tells me that somehow they would still prevail. It's hard to say. I know I've done more books on baseball, and people say, would Babe Ruth have been a superstar today? It's such a different game. But I suspect the answer is, you know, while the athletes are getting bigger, stronger, better, Ruth might not have been as prolific, but he would have still been a heck of a player. I think Lombardi, Shula, those guys, yeah, they would have done okay.
Over time, we kind of see the same several clips of Vince Lombardi. And that's kind of what we know, and we know how successful he was as a head coach. What was he really like?
Yeah, from the guys that I interviewed, I talked to a couple of his linebackers and one of his running backs. They said he's a complex guy, which is no surprise. He was a drill sergeant in many ways. He was very demanding in many ways. But he was also clever. For example, he had a rule that if you showed up to practice on time, you were considered 5 minutes late, but he couldn't find you because you technically weren't late. So that was just a little trick he used, that people would at the very worst show up on time rather than really late. The other side of him, they say with his wife, he was like a little kitten. So, you know, very complex. The story I found most interesting that shows the hard side of him was he was negotiating with Jim Ringo, Hall of Fame center, future Hall of Famer. And they sat down at the table, and Ringo did something unheard of in that era. He brought an agent along. And Lombardi sits down and glances and listens to their demands or whatever for, I guess, just a moment or two. Then he says, excuse me, leaves the room. When he returns, he informs them, you're negotiating with the wrong guy. And they're puzzled. He says, no, you know, you're not a Green Bay Packer anymore. I just traded you to the Eagles. So he was tolerating very little, if anything.
Amazing. Now, one other guy we've seen many times, at least I have through the years, on the sideline. He always was well-dressed. He just stood there pretty much, and talking about Tom Landry.
Right.
Again, what was Tom Landry like beyond what we've seen on TV?
What I gathered from research and so on is that it's easy to just say that's the guy. His image is the person. But on one hand, with his family, he was very warm and open and so on. And he had an explanation for his stoicism, his tough veneer, the cold appearance that he had. And that was, he said he didn't want to get too close with the players, because that would block his vision as far as making decisions that were tough, like I have to cut you or trade you. And he had a heart. Bud Grant's the same story. I was told by Fred Cox, who was from the same town, same block as Joe Montana, that Bud Grant hated to cut people. So Lombardi had that, Landry had that side of him that said, I'll be separated from the players as far as that. And I think it's kind of a cheap joke when people just look at the one side of him, like Walt Garrison. There's a famous story. They ask him if he had ever, he was a running back for the Cowboys, for Landry. And they ask him if he had ever seen Landry smile. And he said, no, but you got to remember, I've only been here 9 years. So that's the stereotypical view.
Can you give us a highlight of one of the favorite games that you looked at from the NFL glory years?
Yeah, there really are two. The 58 playoff game we talked about, what was crazy about that is the players themselves, many of them told me that they didn't know that the game would go into overtime. The rule was relatively new. It wasn't brand new, but they didn't know. They thought they were going to split the championship and the payoff, the check for the game. But I think the Ice Bowl, the championship game between Green Bay and Dallas where the temperatures plunged. I think they said in the morning it was like minus 13 degrees. I think the number used a lot is during the game with the wind chill was 48 below. And some of the lines that came out of that were amazing. Like one guy, it's almost like the old Johnny Carson, how cold was it? Well, one guy said that he threw a glass of water on the window pane in his hotel room when he woke up, and it froze before it could trickle down the pane. Another story was that one of the announcers was sarcastically in the booth, freezing, of course, and he says, well, I think I'm going to take a bite of my coffee now. You know, so that was just staggering, very dangerous, in fact. And I talked to Chuck Mersin, the running back who did a good job that day, and he told me that there was no halftime show and the referees couldn't blow their whistles because their lips would freeze to the instrument, musical, or the whistle, and it would rip your skin off. So it was very dangerous. But yet Mersin said the day before, by Green Bay standards, it was balmy at like 30 degrees, but just some front came in or whatever, and boy, oh boy, was it frigid.
Well, we appreciate you stopping in this morning to share a little bit of your passion for sports and getting these things written down for let other generations learn about sort of the past. Remembering the greatest coaches and games of the NFL glory years and also America's Football Factory, our guest this morning, Wayne Stewart. Wayne, where can people get these books? How can we get our hands on them?
Yeah, they're available anywhere like Barnes & Noble down at Crocker or online, certainly, is one of the easy ways to do it. And actually, I have a book signing coming up at Mind Fair Bookstore. That's the one that's inside Ben Franklin's store in Oberlin. That's like on 13 West College Street, if anybody's interested. Excuse me, that's coming up Saturday, which would be a couple weeks from now, December 15th at 1:30. I'll be there from 1:30 to 3, so that's the Ben Franklin store in Oberlin. So, yeah.
Thanks very much. We appreciate you stopping in, Wayne. Take care.
Oh, it's fun talking to you guys. Thank you.